This week on Lunchbox Envy. Each year, the state of Minnesota supplies 45 million turkeys for it.
It's the holiday that the carol Jingle Bells was originally written for.
But the Canadians started celebrating it 43 years before the Americans did.
It's Thanksgiving! And welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Jack, and I'm here with my fellow QI elves, Manu and Alex.
Hello, Jack.
Hey.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Rootin' tootin'. Darn pleased to be here.
I've never celebrated Thanksgiving.
Really? No, me neither. Straight out the gate, we should say.
Yeah, none of us is American.
No. Yeah, before our American audience start angrily writing in, though, mm-hmm. we do have some expert witnesses lined up for this episode.
Yes.
It's going to be quite a special one.
Yes, absolutely. We do.
Yeah. Okay, so Thanksgiving 101.
We have already had an argument about this in our notes. I originally wrote, Thanksgiving is a secular American national holiday that's held on the last Thursday of November.
Okay. Oh yeah, and then I left quite a passive-aggressive comment in the Google Doc.
But now I don't know. So it's the fourth Thursday of November.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and this is because there's 30 days in November, you might slip in a fifth Thursday some years. Yeah.
Shall we do the traditional old school quick fire story of the Thanksgiving?
Oh yeah, that's
okay, yeah, so quite famously there is like a sanitized version and then there's the real story.
Exactly. So what I thought about when I was a kid, and you said the word Thanksgiving, was in 1621, in the 17th century, Puritans fleeing persecution in England, Christians arrive in America, and indigenous people welcome them with open arms, and they have a big meal, and they eat a turkey, and everyone's holding hands, and it's
sing Kumbaya, don't they?
Exactly.
The history is written by the victors, so it's the same with like the British Empire. Until recently, we were like, oh yeah, you know, we were a benevolent force that just, you know, showed the savages how to, you know, learn Latin and be Christians.
Also, we should probably say the pilgrims didn't call themselves pilgrims at the time. Mm-hmm. They called themselves saints. I mean, which is a little bit of all separatists, as with the other options out. But yeah.
Main character energy.
I mean, yeah, I say like, I'm already bad first impression if you turn off and you're like, guys, we're all saints.
Oh my God.
We ran it on QI a few years ago, but like, they weren't really persecuted themselves. They were seeking somewhere to persecute. They were quite colonial, to be honest.
And they found somewhere.
They'd gone to the Netherlands, and then the people of Leiden didn't like them. So they were like, well, we'll try somewhere else. Let's try this new world.
They basically have that fairly bad vibes. It's just like there's people at parties who you just can't gel with anyone.
Perks of being a Mayflower.
Nice.
Very good. But I think also one of the things I didn't realise was around this story is also kind of the myth of discovery as well. The Puritans at Plymouth, this community later on manages to sell themselves as like some of the first Europeans in America ever, which is super not the case. So the indigenous community that they came into contact with were called the Wampanoag. So they'd been in contact with Europeans who'd come over for like at least a century. Two of the group, of the indigenous group that they met on the beach, already spoke English. And then apparently one of the only reasons that this community were like, hey, let's have a meal, white dudes, is because they wanted to form an alliance with them so they could get a rival community off their backs. And this peace was like really tenuous and only lasted for about 50 years until King Philip's War, which was an enormous bloody battle between settlers and indigenous people.
Is that just emphasis? An enormous bloody battle.
It was a flipping war, is it right?
Massive bloody hell.
And then after that, indigenous people were on the back foot, and it set the kind of precedent for a horrendous history of maltreatment and racism.
What a fun note to kick the podcast off on.
Should we have some turkey?
We should probably address what I said in the intro, that Thanksgiving was held in Canada before it was held in the US. There was an explorer called Martin Frobisher who made a voyage to what is now Newfoundland with his crew in 1578, and they held a ceremony of Thanksgiving, which I think has morphed into the modern Canadian Thanksgiving, whereas the event that sort of kicked off US Thanksgiving Thanksgiving is tied to the feast in 1621 in Plymouth. Before we get too far deep into it, Jack and I actually did speak to a true real life American.
I know.
A Puritan?
Over the internet. No.
We didn't ask, actually.
She's called Gesina Bullock Prado, and she's a chef and a baker and a recipe writer. And, Manu, I guess you just couldn't be fucked.
No, it's, I'm not feeling it today. There's not enough space for more than one woman on the show at the moment, so I gave it to her.
No, we spoke to Gesina a couple of days ago, and Manu was not very well. So here is the chat that we had with Gesina. Hello, Gesina. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about what it is that you do and your books and your shows and your cooking.
I am both American and German, so my background in food is incredibly eclectic, but surprisingly pork and potato oriented on both sides. I am a pastry chef. I'm a baking instructor. I have my own baking school here in the States, in the state of Vermont. And I am a cookbook author, and this is my eighth book, My Harvest Kitchen. And I've had a show on Food Network called Baked in Vermont, which surprisingly is not about cannabis. It is literally about, it's about baking and cooking.
So yeah, we're an all British podcast, so we have really no experience or authority to talk about Thanksgiving. I'm definitely a Thanksgiving virgin. I've never had a Thanksgiving lunch or dinner.
What's wonderful about it, it's always on a Thursday, and it really makes for a lovely long weekend. That's number one. It is quintessentially, as we know, an American holiday. And the tradition is to give thanks in general. So there's no great specificity as far as it's not a religious holiday. And it is supposed to represent, or to some degree replicate, the first meal that the pilgrims had with the natives to celebrate thanks for the bounty of the harvest and for their continuing haha friendship, which didn't last that long. But what is very traditional is having the turkey and the dressing or stuffing and mashed potatoes and gravy and green bean casserole and oftentimes macaroni and cheese and pumpkin pie and pecan pie, and those they're emblematic of that meal. And you often have it earlier in the day, so you have it like my family traditionally does a midday meal, and around all of this is also a good deal of football. American football, I should say.
And is that what makes it different from, because you also do Christmas, obviously, but it's so close in the year. And I feel like it's got quite a lot of similarities in that families come together for it. It's a big meal. It's very kind of cozy.
It is a huge holiday. So it is, I would say, as important to Americans as Christmas is, if it is celebrated in the family. But it also starts off the holiday season. Oftentimes, American families will put up their Christmas tree right after Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, so kind of, I read that people don't start Christmas shopping until afterwards, traditionally.
And hence Black Friday. So Black Friday is literally the Friday after Thanksgiving to start off that very consumer happy holiday of Christmas.
I read that in 1939, there were two Thanksgivings. I think basically retailers were worried because it used to be the case that it was the final Thursday of November that you celebrated Thanksgiving. And in 1939, that happened to be the last day of November. So then retailers were worried that they'd only have like 23 days for people to start Christmas shopping. So then they wrote to the president, and he suggested that they, in fact, I think he officially declared that they move it a week earlier. So it was on the 23rd. But then loads of Republican states, because it was a Democrat president, were like, no, we're not doing that. Like, we're going to celebrate on the 30th as well. So a lot of states did two Thanksgivings.
Oh, wow, we think the country's gone partisan now. Like, that's crazy. It's like Republican Thanksgiving and Democrat Thanksgiving.
I would not complain to have two of those meals. I would be very happy with it.
But a lot of the main people who did badly out of it were calendar makers, because then they suddenly all their calendars are wrong. And they had to rearrange all the Thanksgiving, like you mentioned, football specials. They had to rearrange fixtures. Yeah. And it was dubbed in the press Franksgiving, because the president was Franklin Roosevelt. Right?
Well, and then there's also the Macy's Day Parade. Right, so that's also a huge tradition in the morning for families to watch the parade.
Do you cook your family Thanksgiving, and like, what's your angle on it? Do you have dishes that you like love to make or refuse to make?
I love to make the meal. I have baker's hours, so I wake up early anyway, and I start the breads first. Usually the desserts are already done because things like pumpkin pie and pecan pie are easily done beforehand, and they do well, you know, with a few days wait. And then turkeys are notoriously long cookers, and the turkeys that we traditionally cook are monstrous. Some families deep fry them.
How do you do that? That's ridiculous.
Well, sometimes this is where the internet is fantastic. You will find a host of videos of people exploding turkeys in their backyards.
I'm looking that up.
It's a huge stock pot that they put, of course, a ton of oil in and slowly lower the turkey. And it almost turns into the 4th of July. So there are obviously different ways to do the turkey, but the tradition is that it's usually monstrous and it takes hours. So you start early. But I enjoy the entire process. I find it very soothing. I like to do it myself. And I usually open up a bottle of wine really early on in the day. The other incredibly traditional thing is cranberry sauce. And it is relatively controversial only in that a lot of people there's a specific brand and can. It's called Ocean Spray. It's a can, and then people want to see the ridges that come from the can, and you cut it according to the ridges.
When you say ridges, you mean like it should come out and be can shaped on the table?
Correct. You can serve it that way, but people will often serve it sliced, but using those ridges as the guide for slicing. You know, if it's a family tradition, even if you are a Michelin star chef, if this is what you grew up with, you probably are wanting the thing from the can for Thanksgiving because it's tradition.
Is there much variation in what makes up a Thanksgiving dinner? Because, I mean, for Christmas in the UK, I would say, depending on how posh you are, you might have different meat, you might have goose or something. Is there like a geographic variation on the meal, or does it bring everyone together?
There are geographic variations usually on the side dishes. For instance, my husband is from Colorado, and there they serve a green chili with the Thanksgiving meal, which to me, until I went to his home as an adult, I had never heard of such a thing. And the United States is huge, and regionality is truly, there are pockets of regions like the Midwest, they have their amazing side dishes. And then New Orleans itself, like, you would likely have gumbo with Thanksgiving. Where we are in New England, there's something called Marlboro pie. It's an apple type pie, which used to be the standard pie that no one had heard of outside of the region. But turkey is not optional. Turkey
that's the unifying.
The
turkey and mashed potato, I feel like, is that another?
Mashed potatoes.
The pumpkin pie is the other big, I feel like that's one of the other main character.
Gravy.
And the cranberries,
And right next to pumpkin is pecan pie. So those two are usually standard.
But that is loads of main dishes. Yeah. Seems like you've got so many main course options.
You do spend the whole day making and eating. And then there's always the tradition of having the sandwich. So you do have an official sit down, but everyone knows that you graze for the rest of the day after the meal.
I read everybody knows that the day after is Black Friday for shops, but it's known as Brown Friday for plumbers because it's their busiest day of the year.
Oh no, that's horrible.
Sewage systems get quite overwhelmed with all the guests. But also people throwing away foodstuffs down the toilet.
The greases and the oils. Oh, well, thank you so much, Kazina. Can you tell us any more about your book?
Well, the book should be available pretty much everywhere, and it applies to everyone, baker, cook, grower, shopper. It's just about using the things that are best in season and making beautiful comfort food from them. I think it's so crucial to have recipes at your fingertip that really use beautiful produce and things in season to make incredibly comforting things.
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And you are invited for Thanksgiving.
Amazing. 100% taking off on that offer.
wow, I had no idea that the parade was such a big part of it as well. And the football, it's like a whole, thing.
But that's what I remember from watching episodes of Friends. Like, yeah, that was kind of actually a pretty accurate way of understanding Thanksgiving. I looked up some stuff about the parade. The first one was in 1924, and it was organized, obviously, by Macy's department store as a publicity stunt because, as Gesine said, like, this beginning of the shopping season. Mm. Nowadays, it's really famous for having huge, giant balloons of animals and characters.
Yes.
But for the first few years, they borrowed real animals from Central Park Zoo. No, they didn't inflate them. But elephants, monkeys, camels, all parading through New York streets, which is pretty cool.
Along with
like a band and employees from Macy's.
That's amazing.
Okay, so I feel qualified now to do the rest of this episode. Should we crack in?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it.
Okay, it's time for our first lunchbox, and that is mine. Today, I have brought you guys a mock-up of the first ever Thanksgiving meal.
Ooh. Oh, wait. Hang on a second.
So, what can we identify here?
I'll say what I don't see. I don't think I see any turkey.
Nope.
I don't see any mashed potato.
No green beans.
I don't see any pumpkin pie. I don't see any pecan pie. Pecan. What else did Gesine say was a classic? No cranberry sauce.
Cranberry sauce.
Why are we not seeing those things?
So, should I go through them one by one?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Cranberry sauce. Mm-hmm. Cranberries are native to North America, but our first record of someone making cranberry sauce was not until the 1670s. So 50 years later.
I guess it requires a lot of sugar.
Exactly. So they probably didn't make them into a sauce, basically. They might have squished them up. Potatoes, they weren't available on the northeast coast of the USA.
That is just hell. I would have just got back on the boat.
There's nothing for me here.
No.
Sweet potatoes, similarly, they're still in the Caribbean. They haven't migrated so far north. Pecans as well. They're native to the southern United States.
And
pumpkin pie.
No pumpkin
they didn't
pie.
Have any pastry because they didn't
have pumpkins,
butter,
but no pastry. Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, they may well have had turkey. The only record we have of the meal. So we're talking 1621. And the Pilgrim Fathers, the Puritans who'd come from Europe, arrived on the Mayflower. We have an actual account from Governor Bradford, who is writing letters back home to England.
From the first Thanksgiving dinner?
From the first Thanksgiving dinner. Yeah. The native Wampanoag people did show them how to hunt for various things. And they claim that they sent some men into the forest and they went fowling and came back with a large number of wild birds. So they could have been turkey, they could have been duck, they could have been pigeon.
There was also another first-hand account from another former governor of Plymouth called Edward Winslow, who was there as well. Also very scant. He says fowl, venison, definitely venison.
Yeah, lots of venison. The natives caught 5 deer and brought them back, which is why you see bread rolls and venison pate.
Okay, fine, get it.
Yeah.
Is the spring roll, is that duck? Is
spring
that because
roll represents wild fowl.
Okay, got it, nice. Okay.
Be they duck, pigeon, or turkey.
Okay. There's some fish fingers in there.
Yeah, well, there were cod. Most of the Europeans who'd visited this part of the world were going for cod, which, harking back to the fish episode, we've had potentially Europeans going and travelling and finding cod for 200 years by this point. And that is why the area around Plymouth, where this whole thing's happening, is called Cape Cod to this day.
Oh, of course. That makes so much sense.
Also, just to clarify, the Mayflower left from Plymouth, right? Mm-hmm. And they arrived and they were like, this is also Plymouth.
They didn't even call it New Plymouth.
This is also Plymouth. Like, who does that?
Yeah, like I say, the worst vibes of any group of people. What is that? This congealed beige
that
thing?
That is porridge, because as we've discussed in the podcast before,
everything is porridge.
Hundreds of years ago, everything was porridge.
The original food.
These are, fortunately, the fish finger is acting as a water break to, what the fuck is that?
Okay, that's the final thing in our Thanksgiving dish is eels. So let me tell you a story about a man called Tisquantum, sometimes
great name,
sometimes known as Squanto, which just sounds like an absolute, like, oh, Squanto got so leathered in Malia. Do you remember that time he got off with Governor Bradford? He was a local man of the Patuxet tribe, which is a subsection of the Wampanoags, but he spoke English because about 8 years before, he'd been captured by some cod fishermen and snuck off home to Malaga.
Again, this is getting more Brits abroad by the minute.
Yeah, he went off to Malaga. Yeah, true. In fact, it was an Englishman who caught him and tried to sell him as a slave. This man, Tisquantum, ended up traveling to England, where I think he was bought by an English person, and then eventually he found his way onto a voyage back to his homeland. Mm. So he spent about 4 or 5 years in Spain and then another couple of years in England, and he picked up English. And so when he got back, the sad thing is his tribe had been almost entirely wiped out by a disease the Europeans had brought with them. So he was pretty sad and lonely. So he found himself living with the Poconoquets, who were like a local tribe, mm-hmm. similar. A year later, 1620, the Mayflower sets off. It arrives and Tisquantum and another native who spoke English was called Samoset. And he'd had a similar situation, but he ended up in Somerset, which is where he got his name from.
And big he, up the West Country.
Yeah, yeah. And he was the first person to approach the Plymouth colonists and ask for beer. they didn't have any beer.
Priorities.
The locals have a chief, an elder, a leader known as a sachem. And he was a very respected leader of the Poconoquet tribe. Massasoit was his name. He was a sachem. Sachem is a title.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
So Massasoit either falls in with the native enemy that he's warring with and fights off the Europeans, or he falls in with the Europeans and fights off the native tribe that he's at war with. And Tisquantum was quite decisive in the decision. He nudged Massasoit to go and like make peace with the colonists, the Europeans. So he sent Somerset and later Tisquantum off. And Tisquantum was the man who basically taught the English how to hunt deer and how to plant crops because all their crops were failing. And he had an interesting method of using ground up fish bones as fertilizer, which ended up, schooling the colonists. And one of the things he did was taught them how to find eel, who spend the winter tucked up in a big ball in the mud of a riverbank.
Ooh.
So they're very easy to catch. So he found these eel and brought them back to the Puritans to sort of kind of win their alliance. It's a little bit cynical. We wonder whether he was A, lonely from losing all of his tribe, and B, just like kind of using it for political gains, because he was like, if I can get Massasoit to win his local battle, he'll, you know, treat me like a king. And there was also previous history, like in the Jamestown colony, they had a big beef with the locals. Like,
oh, they had beef.
They had a lot of arguments and violence and bloodshed with the locals. So it wasn't all, this is kind of the one isolated example of slightly benevolent behavior between a certain subsection of the locals and the Europeans.
Right, okay. We're really grasping at straws here for the true meaning of Thanksgiving.
Yeah. But they did have a meal. And so all we know is that they ate a lot of fowl, they had 5 deer, and then they had porridge, a lot of eel, and various bits of like porridge and corn. Mm-hmm. The other myth about Thanksgiving is that the Puritans wouldn't have had Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving ceremonies existed long before as a part of a Protestant faith. So they were happening in Europe before they ever arrived in America. Mm-hmm. And they'd happen like, I don't know, 30 times a year. You'd give thanks for the end of the rains, or like a particularly good harvest, or a military victory. So the first Europeans in America had a number of Thanksgivings before they had this famed feast of 1621.
Isn't it interesting how, even though it's not very, it didn't really happen that long ago, the sources are so all over the place and sketchy.
Yeah. And Governor Bradford's letters are likely to have been quite rose-tinted because he wanted to encourage his mates back home to come over.
Great.
And, yeah, it's like a postcard. Wish you were here. There's loads of eel.
Oh,
it's literally texting, being like, this party is popping off, guys.
Oh,
come on
God.
Over. And then you get there and it's dead. Yeah.
But yeah, we don't have any sources from the natives because they didn't write anything down. They obviously have a lot of oral history, which only lasts as long as your descendants last.
I'm aware that we haven't tried the eel yet. I mean, I'm certainly not trying it. Jack, are you going to go for it?
I just got a shiver down my spine remembering the strumming we had. Can't be that bad.
Oh, God, the way that it makes a noise and like...
I can feel what feels like a spine running down the middle. Shall I avoid that, maybe?
Nice.
Oh, it's very firm.
Tastes
like a firm fish.
With
it's really not that disgusting.
It's just so slimy.
It looks
it is slimy.
Really bad.
But I mean, all fish is slimy, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. So if that's the original Thanksgiving feast, gross, by the way, thank you for making it, but disgusting. Where does the modern Thanksgiving meal come from?
So all of the foods that we traditionally associate with Thanksgiving.
So the turkey, the cranberries, the pumpkin pie.
All of that. All medieval cooking.
Because trade had been going on for, what, 130 years, I guess? Mm-hmm. So like there were turkeys imported from America, but in Europe.
Exactly.
And same with pumpkins and
cranberries as well. Yeah. All of these foods. I spoke to Ken Obala, friend of the pod. Fantastic food historian. Very lovely man.
Hi, Ken.
Hello.
I know he listens.
He says he loves it. He's written about the medieval origins of the Thanksgiving dinner. So Turkey went back to Europe well before 1621. We're thinking about turkeys from America, beautiful oscillated feathers, like the big fan in the back. Exactly. So they're already in Europe. People are already roasting these. People are already carving these. People are already having big feasts. Cranberry sauce is already happening in Europe. So there's a type of cranberry that's indigenous to Europe.
Is there?
The ones that we think of are the American ones, the slightly bigger. But there are smaller ones that were already being used to make these kind of like savory, sour sauces for meats.
Okay.
Those are already being paired. Candied sweet potato, that's already happening.
Really?
So nothing is original. Nothing is American.
There is a very definitive point in which the Thanksgiving as we imagine it comes to life.
Mm.
And it's all thanks to Sarah Josepha Hale.
Yes, I looked into her.
I've heard of her, yeah.
Yeah, she's quite an interesting figure just because she's like really progressive in some ways, but then really, really religious and traditional in others. And obviously she's living in the 19th century, so you get cut some slack. So she was like well up for women's education and trying to edit magazines and writing and doing all these things.
I read about her as well, although I couldn't quite work out what her name was, because some sources say Josephine Hale, some sources say Josepha Hale.
Should we just call her Big Joe?
Big Joe. Let's call her Big Joe, yeah. No.
Big Joe Hale. So she was one of the first American women to publish a novel.
Whoa.
She published Northwood in 1827.
Any good?
I can't say I've read it. I couldn't spare the time.
You know, that difficult first novel, first for your entire gender.
Yeah, true. I don't know if she's more famous, but she also wrote all the lyrics to Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Now
yes,
that is
did.
A banger. I will give that 10 out of 10.
She was actually also one of the first people generally to write openly about the problem of slavery. Relevantly, there's a whole chapter in there about the Thanksgiving dinner. She thought the way to end slavery was for every church in America to have a Thanksgiving collection, which would fund the purchase of enslaved people, educate them, and ship them back to Africa.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, kind of like very hot take.
But I love she just wrote to like government officials enough and pestered them enough that they eventually gave in and made Thanksgiving a national holiday.
She wrote to every single senator of every state for 17 years, including four presidents, until she finally had her way. She was basically like, we need to make Thanksgiving a thing. Let's make it a national holiday. Because at the time, there are only two national holidays. Yeah. There was Independence Day on July the 4th. And then George Washington's birthday, which I don't think
is that still one?
I don't think so. February the 22nd.
It was Abraham Lincoln that finally relented in 1863. And this is during the Civil War. So he is obviously very tired of receiving his mail because he's got a lot going on. Part of it was to kind of unite America because it was intentionally a secular holiday. And traditionally, like we said, it was very religious. Mm. Yeah. So,
and people were sort of worried that there was a lot of non-Anglo-Saxon immigration happening. The Union and the Confederates were both quite nervous about A, America being split in half by the Civil War, and B, some non-Anglo-Saxon immigration, of which there were waves coming. And so they kind of were looking for something to, there's like a national story they needed to build. Mm. And so in 1841, contemporaneous with Big Joe, there's a man called Alexander Young who starts claiming he's found evidence of the first Thanksgiving in 1621. But it was a mix of the letters that William Bradford sent and some friendly sit-downs with the locals that happened at different times and may well have been embellished. But he noticed that they mentioned they had a large store of wild turkeys that autumn.
Oh, is this the first mention of actual turkeys Thanksgiving?
I think so. But the romanticism was stronger than fact, and contemporary historians also jumped on the bandwagon. And then there's a woman called Jane Austen.
No way.
The I've Jane Austen?
No, different Jane Austen.
What?
Jane Austen with an I.
How American as well. Austen, Jane Austen, Texas. Yeah.
But she was an author as well. She published a fictionalized version of the feast.
Fictionalized, but she was sort of saying as if it was true.
I think so, yeah. She was sort of saying, isn't our wonderful history, you know, the first Thanksgiving feast, which included oysters, venison pasties, spices, wine, plums, an enormous stew of everything that was flying in the air that was no longer flying but swimming in a glorious broth. Wow. And basically all sorts of like embellished and delicious sounding stuff. And that became a bestseller as well.
Wow.
And basically just pulled that out of her ass. I mean, I think it was a work of fiction. So suddenly everyone growing up imagined that this feast of 250 years before was this, you know, enormous decadent thing.
So to sum up, the Thanksgiving festival, it's really got nothing to do with giving thanks for the thing that we think it's giving thanks for. They weren't really thankful anyway at the time. They didn't eat what we now eat in homage to it. This is just totally fucking bullshit made up festival.
Okay, it's time for lunchbox number two. And this week that comes from Alex.
I have brought you a phone number.
That's not edible.
This is the phone number for a hotline.
Okay.
Not that kind of hotline, Manu.
I got excited for a second.
It is the Butterball Turkey Talk Line, which is a free 1-800 number run by a company called Butterball in America, which is a very long-running poultry product manufacturer, founded in the 1950s. And since the 80s, they have run a helpline that you can ring, and they will give you free advice on how to cook your turkey and how to fix your turkey cooking emergencies.
Wait, is this all the time? Because I need that at Christmas.
I could tell you all about it, but instead, why don't we ring them and find out for ourselves? They're on the line. Nicole Johnson, who is the director of the Butterball Turkey Talk Line, is on the line now. Nicole, hello. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. This is great. I have been on the talk line for over 20 years, and I've done a lot of interviews, and I don't recall ever doing an interview with anyone from Great Britain, so this is really
amazing. Cool and
very new for me.
Pioneers.
So can you start just by giving us a bit of an intro to what it is, what you do, how it was set up?
Yeah, absolutely. So the talk line is originated in 1981, and there was just a growing need for consumers that were stressed over Thanksgiving or didn't know how to cook a turkey. Needed tips and tricks. There were five female home economists who manned thousands of phone calls. So 44 years later, we've definitely evolved with technology and trends. Not only has our group of five grown, now we have over 50 men and women. We do now have men working the talk line. We've also evolved with technology, but you can also email, you can chat, you can text us.
Do you ever do like emergency home visits? Like, I'm kind of imagining you've got like a Ghostbuster style vehicle with sirens that goes out. And
are you asking if I can fly to Great Britain? No. But we do get that, right? We're sort of called like the turkey counselors. We'll get phone calls and we're on speakerphone. Sometimes it's maybe like a husband and a wife fighting.
It can be quite tense. You have to like talk people down when they're panicking.
Talk them off the ledge a little bit.
Oh my gosh. we're seeing you now in your headquarters in Chicago. Behind you, you've got a whole set of ovens.
Yes, this is our test kitchen. So the talk line itself opens every year November 1st, and our last day is December 24th. But those other 10 months out of the year, we do a lot of testing, a lot with new recipes, because we want to keep current with the technology.
So you're on the cutting edge of turkeys.
Yeah, we certainly are.
Wait, so did I hear correctly, you're going until December the 24th?
Yes, Christmas Eve is our last day of operation.
Okay, so you can do Christmas. Okay, great. Well. Yeah, that's good.
That was my first question. I was like, I need this at Christmas. I need this at Christmas. That's fantastic.
So it is an international thing? We're allowed to call or message even though we're not in America?
You sure are. You absolutely are. And what's really cool about the talk line is it's a seasonal position for us. Outside the talk line, a lot of our folks are holding full-time jobs.
Okay.
It's a very broad group. We have more clinical mindset. We have registered dietitians, food scientists, home ec teachers. But we all love talking turkey.
Yeah.
So we really have a good, dedicated team.
So what's the most avoidable mistake people keep making year on year, would you say?
Yeah, what do you get the most calls about?
Number one question we get is, how do I thaw my turkey? People get very creative. They're shopping a little bit too late, you know? Yeah. So we've heard everything from thawing their turkey in the electric blanket, the dishwasher, you know, leaving it outside in your car, the counter. Not ideal. Not ideal. God. Not the butterball way. And the two safe and acceptable ways to thaw your turkey is refrigeration method. It takes 24 hours for every 4 pounds of turkey meat to thaw in your fridge. Or if you're short on time, or if you don't have the refrigeration space, it's a half hour per pound in the cold water bath method.
Okay.
Okay. Do you ever have to do that? The most difficult part of the job, tell people that if their turkey is beyond saving and they've just got to bin it.
Yeah, unfortunately, those are the tougher conversations that we do have at times. But, you know, we're all about food safety here at Butterball. So if it is a food safety concern, but ultimately it is their choice whether or not they want to discard it or not. And they're usually disappointed if that's what they have to do. But ultimately, you know, they're making the best decisions.
Yeah, and they learn from their mistakes, hopefully, and then don't have to ring you ever again.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, that's something. Do you ever get the same customers every year being like, I've done it again?
That's the most useless
goods, yeah. We do. Oh, we sure do. And a lot of our Talkline team members have 10 years well above my 24. They're 30, 35, 40 years.
Wow.
And so a lot of folks that will call will specifically ask for someone.
Oh, that's so nice. I guess it becomes
long.
A tradition for them as well.
It's kind of like they're part of their tradition, yeah. Right? Oh, which is kind of cute.
That's really lovely. So we thought we might put you to the test and give you some quick fire hypothetical calls. Are you up for that?
Sure. Let's give it a go.
Do you want to start off, Jack?
Shall I do an accent?
I think you should be panicked because
probably
these are emergencies we're calling in.
I'll channel panicked.
Okay. Should I pretend like I'm on the phone?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll start. Okay. Thanks for calling Butterball Turkey Talk Line. Nicole speaking. How can I help you?
Oh, thank you, Nicole. I left the turkey to defrost overnight, but this morning the center is an ice brick. How do I thaw it out in time?
Oh, great question. I will ask you, did you thaw it in the refrigerator or was it left on the counter?
No, it was left on the counter.
Oh, goodness. Well, depending on the size of your turkey, we're going to ask you to take a meat thermometer and see if you can temp the turkey.
Okay.
And we're also going to ask you if it's still cold to the touch.
Okay.
And then we'll determine if you need to discard it or put it in the refrigerator.
Hi, Nicole. There's been a disaster. The electricity has cut out halfway through the turkey cook. How do I finish this roast?
That is a question that we get more than you know.
Really? No.
Do you have a grill that you could fire up and you can
finish? Oh, a barbecue.
Yes, barbecue.
Okay, yes. Amazing, great.
Using that meat thermometer, you want to fire up the grill and you could finish cooking it that way.
Oh.
We can save it.
I placed my turkey too high up in the oven. The top element has burnt the skin, but the rest of the bird still needs more cooking. How do I finish the bird?
Well, you could go ahead and take your piece of foil and you could tent or shield the breast area. That would help to slow it down just a little bit there.
Uh-huh.
It may not have the best food quality right on the breast, but the turkey itself is still going to be safe.
Oh God, I forgot to add seasoning and the turkey has come out perfectly cooked, but it's completely plain. Is there any way of getting some flavor in there last minute?
Okay, well, this is one of the advantages of the Butterball turkeys. They're already pre-brined. If it's a Butterball turkey, you should be okay.
Okay, and if it's not?
You may just want to flatter it with some side dishes.
Reconsider your life decisions.
Yes.
I'm sure I followed the recipe exactly, but the meat is drier than the Sahara. Is there anything that can be done to save it?
Well, in the future, you would want to use your meat thermometer. Next time, don't overcook it. We will perhaps walk them through a gravy recipe.
That's smart. Okay. Everything's better with gravy, yeah.
Oh, Nicole, thank you so much. I'm certainly going to give you guys a call the next time I inevitably mess up my turkey.
Oh, thank you so much. Butterball is certainly here to help. So happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Oh, thank you so much. Oh, that was fun. I feel like I've...
I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot.
The people who keep calling.
Yeah.
Like, I think it would be really nice if I were trying different turkey recipes each year to ring up and be like, oh, I want to speak to Pam and you know...
It's like therapy.
Yeah.
But free.
Yeah, true.
The other turkey institution that comes to mind when I think of Thanksgiving is the turkey pardoning tradition. Do you know about this?
Yes.
Yeah. So famously, the president pardons a turkey in a kind of ceremony. The idea is that he uses his presidential powers to pardon usually criminals and pardons these two birds.
What's the crime? Eating a delicious succulent meal?
It's kind of, well, that's the thing. It's kind of like, it's supposed to be a sort of like light and fun. I suppose it's less funny since there's a president sort of currently abusing his pardoning power somewhat, but...
What happens to them after they've been pardoned?
I think they go to a farm. Mm-hmm. I think they actually do get pardoned.
That sounds made up.
And they get killed next year.
But I think they're usually reared specifically for it now because it's such a big event and they get taken
they're the quite White House. Pretty turkey.
And it's like a light press event in the late 1800s. Okay. Farmers started sending the White House, the president, a sort of prize bird each year to eat for Thanksgiving. And they were just eaten for decades. The president started posing with them, publicity. Okay. And then really, actually, it was George H.W. Bush in 1989.
Oh, wow.
Quite late that he officially started pardoning turkeys.
George Bush's dad.
Yes exactly. It. Yeah. So the first official pardons really were actually from the 80s. Wow. So it's a pretty recent tradition, actually. Really. Mm-hmm. But there was something else I found when I was reading into this. There was actually a different animal effectively pardoned before turkeys were.
Mistake?
Well, this was a raccoon that was sent to the White House in 1926. At the time, raccoon meat was a regional delicacy in parts of the American South. And this raccoon was sent to President Calvin Coolidge to enjoy for Thanksgiving dinner.
The boring president.
Exactly. And they decided not to. They decided they didn't really want to eat this raccoon. Mm-hmm. So they adopted her as a pet and called her Rebecca. Rebecca the raccoon.
Awesome.
Yeah. And she lived in the White House for years. She was given a collar and a leash and was walked around the grounds.
Making big decisions. Yeah. Sorry, their hands are so cute. I know. Well, like, beep, beep, beep.
They're very like human-y hands, aren't they? And she used to apparently go around unscrewing light bulbs and opening and causing chaos.
It sounds like a Disney film.
She became like, it's a kid's book, yeah.
Wow.
She became like a fully-fledged member of the presidential family.
Another thing we have to pattern before this episode goes out.
What, film?
We've had so many good ideas.
I know, there are so many future children's books. I know, yeah.
It's amazing.
So I think that's my takeaway fact from today is that actually the first animal to be pardoned for Thanksgiving was a raccoon.
Wasn't a turkey. Yeah. That's amazing. Okay, it's time for our third lunchbox. And this week, that's yours, Manu. What have you brought?
Today, I have brought frog-eyed salad.
What's that?
That is a good question. So when we started researching for the Thanksgiving episode, the first thing that came to my mind are all of the bonkers side dishes.
Picked your word carefully there.
Yes, I did. And this is one of them. Okay. So the Culinary Institute of America, which is a food college in New York, they have a massive collection of menus and recipes from all over America and the world. And they've got loads of regional Thanksgiving recipes.
Right.
And this is one. So say in the southeastern states, you've got mac and cheese, the really famous one.
Okay.
And Florida, they do key lime pie rather than pecan pie.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
And in the Western Mountain region of the US, they make frog eye salad. So this is really
So just to describe what we're looking at here, it's very brightly coloured. It's congealed. It's yellowy. It's and there's pink bits in it.
So this is a typical Mormon fine dish.
I see. So this is from like Utah.
Exactly. Yeah. In Idaho. So they'll make this apparently not just at Thanksgiving, but other times of the year, but it's been incorporated into the Thanksgiving repertoire. Okay. So in this, there is tinned pineapple.
Ooh, fine. Okay. Yeah.
Tinned mandarin.
Okay.
Nice.
Tinned clementine.
All right. So it's kind of fruit salad-y. Okay.
Marshmallows.
Okay.
Custard.
This is going a bit south.
Bit of dairy and fruit.
Oh,
I'm
not sure about this.
Pasta.
Oh, no. Has Mrs. Beaton been in touch?
This is so Beaton-coded.
Also, in homage to Rosie, I cooked the pasta in the microwave because I didn't have the office. So it went really, like, mushy.
Even less highbrow.
So, yeah, it was cold pasta, all of these things mixed together, put it in the fridge, and now we're going to eat some.
I want to get a good spoon.
Oh.
All the little separate components.
In a lot of the other recipes, they have like Cool Whip or whipped cream.
Oh, no. This is... the texture and the taste just don't go.
They're bad.
I think if you are used to it, then... It's just because we've got so many associations with pasta and savoury that we can't really separate.
Yeah.
But I think generally the tastes are pretty good.
It's not the most offensive thing we've had on the show.
It's very sweet.
I think it's just unnecessary. Why? Why have they done that?
Yeah, why?
Because America.
It's the land of innovation, right?
They're really, especially with Thanksgiving, they really don't mind mixing sweet and savoury together.
Okay.
Another famous dish that's super sweet on the Thanksgiving table is the sweet potato casserole, which famously is covered in a sea of roasted marshmallows.
Oh, wow.
It's really interesting because, like a lot of the foods we've spoken about, there was like a really strong campaign to push this ingredient.
Oh, really?
By a producer.
The marshmallow companies, yeah.
Exactly. So,
big marshmallow. But,
you know, like in Ghostbusters. Yeah.
So historically, marshmallows were medicinal.
Okay.
In ancient
Wait, sorry, Egypt. Are we talking about the plant, the marshmallow?
Yes.
So, okay, right, right.
The marshmallow.
I didn't even know that marshmallow comes from plants. Like,
yeah, it's from a plant.
From the mallow that grows in the marsh.
Yes.
No, oh my God.
So it's the sap from the marshmallow plant.
Okay.
And back in the day, it used to be served as like a sweetened gloop to make it more palatable. Nice. And that was supposed to soothe sore throats, which studies have recently shown it might actually help with.
Oh. Cool.
And then in the mid-1800s, marshmallows were like a really, really hard thing to make, as we know them now, kind of like fluffy loads of egg whites.
Like
they
a
were individually
dessert, almost,
exactly.
Yeah.
So and like, was like one made for the king, and like it was really artisan.
Well, I think a few little ones made, but it was very fancy, like okay, really
like
hard to get hold of. And then
it feels like they should be. It feels like we shouldn't really have such an abundance of them now.
Well, you can thank Joseph Demarath. So in 1895, this man figured out how to industrialize the process using gelatin and loads of machinery.
Yeah.
And then marshmallows become like widely available, mass produced, and companies have like this glut, basically, of marshmallows.
Okay, yeah.
And then they release...
There's too many marshmallows everywhere.
What are we going to do?
Drowning in marshmallows. it's like that bacon crisis.
Oh, yeah. Well, exactly.
They had too much bacon. It was so stupid.
So in 1915, there was a confectioner called the Bundt Brothers that released a marshmallow cookbook, which had so many different ways to cook them. So that one kind of got lost in...
It's a lost cookbook of history.
It is, but that's one of the first marshmallow cookbooks. The second more famous one is by Angelus Marshmallows that was released in 1917.
That's a company, I presume, not a person.
Yeah, that is a company. And they are the people that not only pushed the sweet potato marshmallow casserole, they also pushed marshmallows in hot chocolate.
Finally, we get to a good use for marshmallows.
Yeah, I know. There's also a company called Campfire that released their marshmallow cookbook, and they have one that includes like a chicken salad marshmallow dish.
No.
So yeah, that's what I wanted to bring. Crazy salad dish. You're welcome.
It's a novelty. I've never had it before.
I've never been happy to be British. It's only again, I'm not a Mormon.
People think our food's like bland, but at least it's not wacky and out there like this.
Also, we haven't spoken that much about cranberry sauce.
No.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Which is a really big part of the Thanksgiving meal. Cranberries float because they're so sour. Do you know this?
Float because they're sour.
I've seen the adverts for Ocean Spray where they're like gathering in the cranberry harvest, and I never really questioned it.
So they're kind of grown in water. So in the early 1800s, a man called Henry Hall figured out that if you cover cranberries in loads of water and sand, it's really good for their vines, and they keep more water on the roots, and it's like a whole, basically they love growing in water.
Kind of like rice.
Yeah,
we talked about how it doesn't like growing in water, but it tolerates it really well.
Exactly. But one of the reasons they grow so well in water is because they float, because they're full of air.
Okay.
And one of the reasons it's beneficial that they float is because they're so sour, there's not many animals that want to eat them.
Okay.
So they're not dispersed in animal feces as much.
It's a way of propagating.
Exactly. They're like, you know what? We're just going to take the river. You guys, we don't need you.
Sweet. So then that's cool.
It's so
that's
cool.
Very clever. Did you read about the cranberry bounce test?
No, but it's ringing a bell.
Well, you basically have to like bounce a cranberry down some angled stairs. And if it doesn't bounce beyond that step, it's not for sale. And if it does bounce beyond the step, then it's perfectly plump and ripe.
Wow.
Then are they not just bruised and a bit manky after you've
I don't think
them
so, because they're pretty tense and firm.
Because only the bounciest ones make it. So. Because I didn't really cook anything for my lunchbox, I actually made a trifle. Would you like some to finish off?
Yeah, I'd love some trifle. Is this traditional?
Yeah, trifle Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Let's dig in.
Thank you, Alex.
Have you done a Rachel Green?
I've done a Rachel Green. Let me go through the layers. We've got ladyfingers, jam, custard, beef, peas and onions, and whipped cream. I thought I'd give this a go since in the episode, the reason Rachel doesn't bat an eyelid when she puts beef in is because it was an English recipe. And she thinks we do weird stuff.
That's so true.
Oh, it is horrible.
Oh, Alex, well done. You put in so much effort.
Oh, it's so nasty. I didn't realise how horrible it would be.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy.
You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
That's right. And you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes or questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Yes. Why don't you tell us what you're thankful for? We'll see you next week and have a very happy Thanksgiving. Goodbye. Yeah,
happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Manu Henriot, me, Jack Chambers, and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.